Hello and welcome to the fourth episode of the MIR podcast, a show dedicated to science education that focuses on topics such as climate change, Earth's energy imbalance, heat adaptation and climate restoration using surface reflection technology. I'm Peter Dines, a director at MIR and the host of this podcast. Once again, Dr. Tao will be joining us to be our educator on this journey. Dr. Tao is the founder and director of MIR, which stands for Mirrors for Earth's Energy Rebalancing, an organization he set up to tackle the greatest threat that humanity has ever faced, namely Earth's energy imbalance. MIR is a non-profit organization focusing on surface SRM adaptation and mitigation research, and also climate education, which this podcast is a part of. Over time, we will be discussing everything to do with climate reality, to feasible mitigation, to adaptation, the latest scientific papers, and what's going on with the MIR project on an ongoing basis. If you do have suggested topics that you wish for us to cover, you can tweet us at MIRSRM on X, or alternatively contact us through our website MIR.org. Like I said, the organization is a non-profit and we are funded by individuals at this stage, so any donations are always welcome to further our research and humanitarian efforts. You can go to MIR.org/donate to do so. In this episode, we hear about the ongoing heat waves in West Africa, as well as the issues they're currently having with power cuts in Sierra Leone. We also revisit one of Dr. Tao's early symposium presentations and delve into the controversial topics he discussed and the information he shared back in 2020. He provides more detailed explanation on lots of different topics, including the masking paradox that our current civilization currently faces. Okay, let's get started then. So, how is everybody holding up down there at the minute? And we've heard there's been many power cuts this week for maybe 5 or 6 days. So what's the latest situation?
So we start to realize that maybe by midweek, by Wednesday, typical power cuts, 2/3 of the day is quite typical. So for the first couple of days, we didn't really pay attention. But then from Thursday to Friday, now Saturday, people have been asking questions and we've been changing some details, and things like Freetown, at least since Monday, there has not been consistent power. So what I heard is usually the power is supplied by the Turkish ship that's docked outside of the Freetown Harbor.
Mm.
I don't know the exact number of the wattage, but it's several tens of megawatts of power from what I heard.
Mm-hmm.
And now they are only supplying about 10% of the original power.
Wow.
At the interim period until something gets paid by a certain date. If there's no payment, it's possible that we would get the complete shutdown of the power to the Freetown area.
Wow.
Well, so that's the situation in Freetown, but also in the provinces, in Makini, Bo, and other remote areas, the situation seems to have been going on for actually longer.
Mm.
Sometimes several weeks, maybe 2 months. So it's not really clear what is going on. It could be hydroelectric power stations are not providing the power because of insufficient water captured or just fast evaporation over the past month.
Mm-hmm.
So that's possible, but obviously we haven't done the on-site checks.
Goodness.
So
these
are just stories circulating around.
That's crazy. It's a volatile situation there. I mean, I hope you and all the team are keeping safe and as cool as possible. I hear there's people queuing for ice and water and things like that as well.
Indeed. I have witnessed that myself just on the way to this location where I'm taking this call from. There are these vendors for ice. I think they go for maybe $4 or maybe 20 pounds to 30 pound range bag. So it's quite expensive.
Wow.
And we usually use them to cool drinks and water to sell mm-hmm. in the street. So it's like a small merchant depends on this ice. I think roughly speaking, maybe 1 kilowatt hour of energy goes into making that bag, but they're going for $4 a kilowatt hour electricity, you know, a few tens of cents. So people are paying a lot for getting access to these basic amenities. The queue is like a few hundred people long, as far as I could see when I was passed back to queue.
Wow. And how are people like charging their mobile phones and whatever as well?
So that's very essential need, apparently. And people say some people would rather skip meals in order to have their phones charged.
Goodness.
Right now, it goes for $0.25 per charge. Imagine somebody does 2 charge cycles per day, so it's like 50 cents, which is, you know, half to a third of their daily
Goodness.
Total earning allowance. So
wow.
These access to very basic energy is really eating into people's budget. And to charge a phone, the energy required is about 1% of a kilowatt hour. So it's really nothing. And they're paying 20 times the price for it.
Goodness.
But let's see. Maybe, we don't know. Maybe this situation would prompt a transition to renewable charging, solar charging. But it could also be a very temporary situation.
Yeah.
So we don't know how the dynamics would unfold in the coming days, weeks.
Goodness. Well, I mean, that all being said as well, I mean, last week there was record-breaking temperatures in 48.5°C, I think, in Mali, a couple of weeks ago. And the entire Western Africa region looks to be experiencing really extreme heat this year. I mean, have you personally noticed any difference from last year?
I have, indeed. For one thing, the power supply has been much more intermittent. Maybe last year, if I remember well, we probably got blackout maybe half to a third of the night.
Mm.
Right now, it's probably 70 to 80% of the time there's no power over. And as you can imagine, when 30 degrees Celsius out and 80%, 70% humidity, the temperature and humidity really infiltrate the old construction buildings rather quickly. So I've been personally waking up almost every night around 2, 3 a.m. You need to take a shower to cool down to be able to try to get some sleep.
Goodness.
And it's quite general. Everybody wakes up sweaty, and half the people I meet have some sort of heat rash over their body.
Wow.
Because of the heat.
It must really affect productivity as well, I'm assuming.
Most certainly, right? If you don't get a good night's rest, and during the day, you only are exposed to even more severe heat stress indoors and outdoors. Outdoors, it goes to 33 to 35 degrees Celsius, depending on the location, the microenvironment. And indoors, it's not, it's about the same, 34 degrees Celsius. But then you also have less ventilation, so it's different. So people who have no access to electricity, which is more or less everybody, except for the very privileged few who have their personal generators, are not able to escape from the sweltering heat.
Wow. And you're also one of the people as well, until we get our passive house built at some point, hopefully, in the future, which might help.
Yeah. So I think one very useful aspect of really working on the ground, experiencing what people are fighting against every day, is it really forces one to think of ways to deal with the situation. So
yes.
The passive health project is inspired by personal suffering.
Absolutely. Well, listen, look, anyway, I want to take us back really to when I first discovered your work as well. And you were given a nanoscience conference presentation back in 2020. At that time, you talked about some things that might have seemed a bit, controversial back then. But since then, a lot of it is kind of a reality in some respects. But we can go over a few of those in the process here. But one of the things was the masking effect. Now, I was personally, awakened to the masking effect myself, actually, in the early noughties when the BBC did a documentary on global dimming. And I just couldn't believe I'd never heard about that concept and the paradox. And I wasn't really sure what could be done about it. When did you first learn about the masking effect yourself? And is that why in the presentation you gave, you mentioned that, putting aerosols into the atmosphere is probably still required at this point, until we have thermal mitigation?
I personally probably heard first after September 11th. I must have watched documentary or news reports of how clearing up the sky led to increasing diurnal temperature range. I don't even remember when. It's probably before 2010. But I really became fully aware after listening to podcasts and interviews and talks by Dr. Guy McPherson. He is probably the most vocal person back then, when very few people were talking about this this aspect. So I attribute my full understanding to the teachings of Guy McPherson.
And you saying about, in that presentation, you said about, more or less burning dirty coal and putting aerosols into the atmosphere, which would seem very controversial to people. But I'm assuming you had a good reason for saying that.
Well, that's just based on historical observation of how more or less to first order the warming effect of greenhouse gases, CO2 and other particulates and other aerosols that co-emitted as a result of post-emission photochemistry. The two forcing the positive heating and the cooling more or less balanced out for much of the last century, before the recent 2-3 decades when the heating curve really emerged out of noise. So it's quite obvious now, if you look back at the data, how the apparent cooling back then could be largely because of the relative quality of the coal used back then, the lack of regulation before countries, organizations started to take really stringent regulations on emission standards. So in a sense, or quite unfortunately, we have been tricked into believing maybe the emergence of the signal for global warming would be much longer into the future because the historical warming trend and how much CO2 went into driving that trend was a gross underestimation of the real heating power of these greenhouse gases. So it's quite unfortunate. I think probably the historical data also helped to bias some computational models that were trying to capture the historical temperature trend.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, we know now that the aerosol component is very difficult to measure. You have to do that indirectly because we simply do not have the infrastructure to monitor the concentration of aerosols everywhere in the atmosphere. And then we don't have satellites to monitor the radiative impact and its interaction with light at every location on Earth, right? So we depend on a lot on observation of clouds and other secondary measurements mm-hmm. to infer in the end, mm-hmm. The impact of aerosols. And clouds are ridiculously difficult to measure. They change a lot in shape. So once again, how much of the surface area of Earth can you cover at any given time? What fine temporal resolution images you can take? All of those make the attribution of aerosol protein all that much more difficult from experimental point of view.
Yeah.
And because much of the cloud microphysics of how the water particles condense on these particles are not really well understood.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of uncertainty. You cannot derive that from first principles because the fundamental lab experiments have simply not been done. One example is there is a debate on what happens to, say, aerosols when we inject them into the stratosphere. For example, aerosols that are not SO2 derived, but rather say calcium carbonate derived.
Mm.
But because of our incomplete understanding of how nanoparticle surface chemistry occurs, what are the mechanisms? We don't know how they then interact with water, how they then interact with nitrogen species, how the complex chemistry takes place.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there's so much uncertainty, and unfortunately, the dirty coal used initially really played a role in numbing, you know, both society, also, in my estimation, the climate simulation community seems to underestimate the impact of passing.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, and the shipping emissions is another topic that's quite a hot topic at the minute. Have you analyzed that decrease in the sulfur emissions from the shipping regulations? You know, do you think that's having any impact over the heating over the North Atlantic?
I'm no expert. I only just read the headlines and a few selected paper passages. I think shipping accounts for maybe about on the order of like 10% of the aerosol emissions.
Right.
And I think they're contributing up to 0.6 watts per meter squared. Forcing, which is quite substantial, right? That's like a quarter of the CO2 forcing on the upper estimate. So it's quite substantial for how little it's being emitted. And they're very powerful because they are operating over marine clouds, which are masking really dark ocean surface. So that's what's giving a marine cloud derived from shipping aerosol
mm-hmm.
the extra cooling power compared to emissions over land. Right. So
yes.
Yeah.
And why do you, I mean, if that's the case, I mean, why do you think that, you know, policymakers don't understand that situation? And, you know, obviously the regulations are put in for a good reason in terms of human health and air pollution, et cetera. But I mean, surely somebody's looking at the bigger picture.
I'm sure. And I wouldn't really want to speculate on why policymakers are not really operating based on the full scientific understanding. Except to say that not everybody spends the time thinking about these different intricacies as you and I and many other listeners of this podcast. One thing is spatial heterogeneity. Very few people really understand when they hear about, say, 1.5 degrees Celsius global warming, that it's a global average, that it's a different amount over the oceans mm-hmm. versus over land, and it's a different amount over the tropical land surface area versus the Arctic mm-hmm. areas. So these spatial heterogeneity are even sometimes, you know, downplayed or basically hidden from the people, not hidden intentionally, but when you are trying to distill some central message, invariably you lose resolution and you cannot talk about these details in a 5-minute news report.
Right? No.
So in a sense, the way we tell stories, the way the attention span of the population has been tuned down, all contribute to this oversimplification of the science.
Mm-hmm.
So people are no longer thinking for themselves. So
yes.
I don't know if people understand, okay, you emit over the oceans, actually it's not really impacting people in the cities who, because the air doesn't travel at the speed of the light, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they fall down on the order of, you know, within a radius of a couple thousand square kilometers due to the frequency of precipitation. So these details, I don't think many people think about.
No.
And policymakers are not known for meditation.
Certainly not. I mean, and I think if the people of Europe probably understood that the temperature rise there over the last year has probably been in around 4°C, never mind 1.5°C. Maybe that might wake a few more people up, but that's not what the main message currently is. So anyway, let's go back to the presentation. And in that presentation, you said that, you know, afforestation wasn't enough, and you said that the albedo heating more or less would cook us. I mean, why can't we plant our way out of this planetary warming crisis, you know, by putting forests all over the planet?
Well, it's been quite a while since I gave that presentation. So I will just try to recite a few numbers that I still remember. One is the amount of carbon embodied in the biomass, mostly the stem of trees when they're at maturity. And typically when people are doing these studies in the agroforestry field, the unit of measure for area is a hectare. So a hectare is roughly 2 acres, slightly over 2 acres for people in the States and in the UK. And it's roughly the size of the football field. It's a piece of land that's 100 meters on the side, a square piece of land, 100 meters on the side. So 330 feet roughly on the side. All right. And if you count how much carbon that's in the trees, over these areas, say in Asia, East Asia, the number comes out to be about 50 to 60 tons of carbon. If you compare then the amount that's in the equator, in the tropical rainforest, then it's roughly 300. In the Amazon rainforest, it can go to 300, 350 tons per hectare. Mm. So right away, again, we see there's a tremendous spatial heterogeneity, right, of up to like factor 5 or 6. So besides the above ground biomass that's embodied in the stem, there's also below ground biomass, the root system, and also the soil carbon you need to take into account. But generally speaking, those are minor compared to the what's visible on the ground. I think below ground, like the roots, they're roughly around the 10 to 20% at most. So to first order, the above ground is what you want to look at. So that's one thing. So that's the stand content at the maturity. But when you plant a forest, they don't really grow instantaneously. It takes time for the carbon to be converted to long-term storage wood, right? Some of the sugars that are photosynthesized, captured during the growth season, will be utilized by the plant themselves for respiration. So at the end of the annual cycle, there's actually a certain amount of carbon that's captured per hectare. And generally speaking, it's about 1 ton of carbon per hectare. Because 1 hectare is a huge area, 1 ton of carbon is actually not that much. Then we can think about, okay, how much a piece of land do we actually need to absorb all the CO2 that's ever that's emitted during the whole year, right? And we know like the current equivalent CO2 emission per year is 50 gigatons. So that's 5 × 10^10. And if each hectare is only capturing on the order of 1 ton carbon, which is 2-3 tons of CO2, then we need equivalently about 2 × 10^10 hectares to store all that carbon. But 2 × 10^10 hectare is half the surface of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's larger than the total surface area of land that we have available by roughly a factor of 2. And we know that roughly 45% of the habitable land is already used by humans for agriculture and city building, etc.
Yeah.
So roughly speaking, we are short on available land to perform this task just to absorb the annual emission. We're short by a factor of 10. In other words, we need a 10 planet Earth in order to rely on afforestation or land restoration to handle the annual emission of CO2.
Okay.
So that's just, you're trying to store that carbon away. But that's not the whole story, I think, as I pointed out in the presentation, because the carbon that's stored away in biomass is not innocent from a climate perspective, because we are turning a desert, which has the albedo of 0.4, back to a lush forest or alpine forest with albedo 0.1, 0.15, you are increasing heat production by its interaction with the sun by a huge amount.
Yes.
And if you factor that in, it turns out, and it has been recently confirmed by multiple publications, people actually looked into this in very detail. I only sketched out the qualitative argument. And the more recent quantitative calculations fully support that. Basically, in most locations on Earth, you're doing more harm than good by promoting the growth of forests, especially locations such as East Asia, the alpine forests that I mentioned that have a low intrinsic carbon storage intensity of 50 tons or 60 tons per hectare.
Yes.
It's only in the very selected areas, which are still mostly wooded, the Amazon forest, where it could have a beneficial impact. But even then, it's very minimal compared to what you can achieve otherwise.
Yeah. Well, it would be good to try and save the Amazon forest, then, I suppose, in that instance, at least.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The funding should be into how do you save forests, preventing people from cutting them down for a variety of reasons, including providing basic cooking fuel, which is a major driver in these areas.
Yes. Well, solar cookers would certainly help in that regard, do you think?
Of course, of course. And that's another side project that we worked on and more or less have a few prototypes that work. We're just hoping to find the investors or philanthropic individuals, organizations willing to help scale this thing. Because living here, I witnessed how quickly the tree lines are receding.
Yeah.
There is a very famous, beautiful waterfall near Freetown called the Mumbo Waterfall. Mm-hmm. When I first arrived last year, when I visited, back around the same time, this time last
yes.
year, you had to walk maybe a half a mile, more or less, in the forest before you reach the location where the waterfall is. Right now, it's fully cleared all the way up to the front of the waterfall.
Wow.
Half a mile. And it's all for charcoal making. For
cooking. In just 12 months?
In 12 months, you have cleared 1 mile of
of
tree line.
It's just incredible when you think of the amount of energy that is available there from the sun for solar cookers.
Yes. So it's very unfortunate situation because people are suffering from the sun's heat. And then they're adding it more by burning the charcoal. And also even more by making the charcoal in Freetown surroundings, which is also an exothermic process.
Yes.
So everything we do is just adding more heat to the system.
Wow. And in terms of lowering the albedo, I'm assuming that PV panels then, if you were building them out at a huge scale to try and power, the global civilization, that kind of lowering of the albedo would have the same effect as too many dark trees areas?
So we can think about this situation from the albedo values for these devices. So trees, we said, on average are between 0.1 to 0.15 in albedo. And solar panels, when they're not when they're fully functioning and not soiled, are about 0.05. So they are even darker than the trees to start. But of course, part of the energy that's absorbed, or more of the energy that's absorbed is, by the solar panels, are converted into electricity. Let's say average 15%. For the average vehicle devices out there, those that are under operating conditions that have seen some degradation, minor degradation.
Yeah.
So the effective albedo of solar panels is about 0.2, slightly brighter than trees. But trees also, you know, store away roughly 1 or 2% of that energy in photosynthesis. So roughly speaking, they are within 90% of each other in terms of darkness.
Mm.
So the heat produced on the solar panel and trees are roughly equivalent, except trees convert part of the heat to wet heat or latent heat.
Yes.
AKA moisture, rather than the heat that you can measure with a thermometer or due to the expansion of air molecules. So that's one difference. And the whole community of say city-wide adaptation for fighting urban heat island effect has been tricked into thinking that the lower sensible heat that's measured around the trees are actually a sign of them cooling the city.
Yes.
Well, in fact, it's only because trees are converting part of the what you can measure and hiding it in moisture, which exerts more or less equivalent physiological impact for people. Because when you increase the humidity of the air, it becomes more difficult for people to cool by perspiration. So your sweating mechanism for cooling no longer works when it's very humid outside. And the rule of thumb is that for every 10% increase in air moisture, it's equivalent to 1.5 degrees Celsius, 3 degrees Fahrenheit increase in the dry bulb temperature. So if somebody measures, say, a cooling by trees of the area by, say, 0.5 to 1 degree Celsius, if the humidity concurrently increased by, you know, 7%, then actually you're not having any actual benefit.
Mm.
And some of the older studies that you know, have informed the current practices of planting trees didn't really fully take those into account. And it's typical the case, you know, between medical research and clinical trial and prescription by your doctor, there's maybe 20-year delay. I think the same sort of delay is happening in the climate health and the climate adaptation field. So the research that's being implemented now is like 20 years out of date.
And I mean, doesn't it put more strain on water resources, which are also strained as well? I mean, it reminds me of the story of the lady in outside Kuwait who was attempting to grow a forest outside the city, and you know, she had this huge diesel tanker pulling up with water every sort of hour to keep these things alive. Yeah. And you know, it's kind of kidding yourself in a way.
Yeah, exactly. That's also the fundamental reason why much more than 95% of tree planted for reforestation and afforestation have never survived, because there's no after planting care, and there's nobody there to water them. And even if there's labor available, there's oftentimes no water available. And the biggest reforestation project that's been attempted has been done in China since like 30 years. And they have succeeded in greening a large part of the country. But if you look at the recent literature, maybe from the past 3 or 4 years, the focus has been how this planting has contributed to soil desiccation and depletion of groundwater.
Mm.
Because when you're planting trees that weren't there, even if you kept them alive by just irrigation, eventually they develop deep enough roots. And then these roots then tap into groundwater.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Right, they have to. As much energy comes down in the sun equals how much energy is evaporated in water. Vaporization and enthalpy of vaporization.
Yes,
you cannot fight physics.
So, and that's a lot of energy.
That's a lot of energy. So it's all the solar energy you want to capture, but it's wasting your water. So it's a terrible, terrible idea for adaptation.
Okay, well, look, we'll move on from trees before we get in trouble. During the conference as well, you probably get in trouble for this as well, but you know, you mentioned about powering civilization using wind turbines, and you said that that could potentially have an unintended warming effect as well. And this is, you know, because of a large number of wind turbines apparently would be required, and that could cause friction, and you have disturbance and mixing in the different air layers as well. And you think you said, actually, we would instantly, you know, if we powered the globe with wind turbines, we would instantly more or less break the 2C barrier. So can you explain that? Is that still your thinking?
That's actually one of the field I first looked at and really shocked me as the, you know, equally compared to the aerosol masking effect. Because I think that's the first instance when I realized that maybe we're not really doing the right thing or having the right approach to solving this issue. So the problem with this wind turbine problem is, again, our limited understanding of the structure of the planet Earth and the complexity of the structure of planet Earth. Previously, we mentioned this land-water division. But now, to talk about wind turbines, we have to talk about the degree of freedom in Z, the height of the Earth. When people talk about global surface air temperature, it refers to temperature measured at the 2 meters above the surface. And that measure matters for humanity, especially because most people are around that height. And we ourselves experience that temperature. And also our animals, our crops, they also are more or less interacting with that temperature. So for the human habitat, that 2 meter air temperature is very important. If you're talking about, say, if we were eagles, we might, have our standard measurement at 10 or 20 meters because that's where we're roosting. And maybe even higher up because that's where you're spending the day cruising and trying to find your prey.
Yes.
But we're human, so we're talking about the 2 meter air temperature. And the structure, the vertical structure of temperature of the atmosphere varies every day as a result of the solar radiation coming in during the day and disappearing at night. During the day, what happens is most of the energy gets captured by land, turning to heat. So it's like you have a hot plate. And the hot plate is interacting with the air immediately above it, making it into warm air, and warm air tends to rise. And this leads to rising motion and also creation of clouds, when you have the co-transport of this buoyant air and also moisture into layers that's higher and cooler, so clouds can condense. So during the day, this hot plate is performing a mixing motion of the lower part of the troposphere. So that's the mixed planetary boundary layer during the day. So all the pollutants produced in the city, thanks to this effect, gets transported upward. So it's diluted, and so that's helping with the alleviating pollution. Say if the cities were running, at the same intensity of emissions during the night, that would be horrible because all the pollutants would be stuck at the ground. Why? Because at night, the surface would have started to cool down faster. And this the coolness would then cool the lower part of the atmosphere faster than the upper part. Mm-hmm. And when the air becomes cooler, it becomes denser. And denser things like to stick to the bottom. And thereby, you have a increasing temperature with height. And this structure is stable, meaning it doesn't tend to move. So air molecules will not change. They exchange very much. But also during the night, when there's no disturbance, then you have a very cool and breezy night on the ground, so you can sleep and rest very well, both for humans and also for our crops, many of which need a really low nighttime temperature in order to properly function physiologically due to various mechanisms.
Yes.
And there are studies looking at how nighttime heat waves can really mess plants up. For one thing, they might need to use a lot more of the energy stored during the day in respiration to survive the night when the temperature is higher because all the molecular processes are going faster.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens when you have wind turbines around is that the wind doesn't necessarily stop at night. And as a result, the interaction of the wind with the turbine, which have both vertical and vertical motion, as it spins, will give the air such momentum that it can create turbulences and mix up a few hundred meters of air between the upper atmosphere and the ground. So what it's doing is it's bringing the hot air up high that hasn't had time to cool down below to the surface. So the average temperature at 2 meter height, which is what we care about, would be on average higher because of this mixing of air up high and lower down.
Does yes, that make sense? Yes. Wow. So if you did that on a major scale, it would certainly have an effect.
Certainly would have an effect if we're trying to produce all
18 terawatts
of energy from solar.
All right, let's move on from wind and trees before we really get into trouble. So back then you were talking about building the mirrors out of glass due to the abundance of materials, etc. So why have you shifted towards, using recycled PET plastics with aluminium?
So I think that initial, I would say, short sight is partially a legacy of my former PhD training. And one of the projects we were looking at was to make cantilever beams that are like a sort of force sensor out of different materials. And we just found that for whatever reason, several reasons we don't have time to get into, when you carve and etch cantilever beams out of a single crystal diamond, a very expensive, high-end material, they perform the best due to a variety of properties, one of which is chemical stability. And when I initially did the techno-economic feasibility analysis for MIR, one of the major or very important parameters going into the calculation was the durability of the system, because if you want to spend the least energy and to provide the most cooling, then you certainly want your cooling infrastructure to last longest. So the replacement time is as long as possible, so you don't need to crank out so many new devices per year to upkeep your infrastructure. So, you know, between those lines of yes. thinking, you know, better build it high quality and last longer than to make it cheap.
Of course.
And have them rot away. I initially started to go down the glass route. Mm-hmm. Because as far as we can tell, if they can be somehow protected from hurricanes, let's say, and in many locations around the tropics, there aren't that much hurricanes to worry about. So there are vast locations on planet Earth where the usual suspects, hurricanes, flooding, and even hailstorms are not typically an mm-hmm. issue. And in those areas, it really makes sense to put something down that's highly durable, that's highly erosion resistant, and nothing seems to do better than glass, mm-hmm. which is sense. So, and back then, there was already field data available showing like glass-based mirrors using energy capture can last for 30 years without any measurable degradation. So if it hasn't changed over 30 years, it's quite safe to say that in a factor of 3 or 4, you know, on century time scale, low century time scale, they have the potential to last that long.
Mm-hmm.
And at that kind of durability, then it becomes really feasible to do this globally, even using currently existing glass manufacturing resources.
Yes.
But then what's really, you know, made the shift was also, you know, as from that time until now, I and like everybody else have been surprised by the speed of global warming acceleration. Mm-hmm. If you look at my presentations, I was projecting, you know, reaching the official 1.5 by the end of this decade.
Yes, like,
but lo and behold, it has gone twice as fast.
I think we're at 1.6 over the last 365 days.
Yeah, so the timeline over which we need to implement this adaptation framework for global cooling has, you know, if you are an experimentalist, has shrunk by a factor of 2.
Mm.
So maybe, you know, originally we had like 40, 50 years, 60 years to implement the infrastructure by the end of the century. Now we don't.
Mm-hmm.
We really need to be thinking about over the next decade or two to have the capability to stop any further worsening of the system.
Mm-hmm.
So within such a short time, we really can't, you know, think about what are we going to shop in a grocery store to cook dinner with. Let's just open the fridge and larder and see what we can whip up using that's already available.
Yeah.
You know, even open the trash to see if there's we throw away some food stuff that can be rescued. And that's what inspired us looking into what are we dumping into landfills. Mm. And in landfills, we have roughly equal amount of glass and plastic waste and also organic food waste and some part of metal. So then through just looking at the different physical properties and what they already are used for, it turns out that the PET has already been used to make mylar, which is reflective material, and also various sorts of reflectors. And all the beverage bottles for bottled water are also made out of PET, which is a very incredibly strong material. If you think about how it's basically impossible for a single person to break a water bottle by hand.
Yeah.
And we have since learned to also upcycle this the material directly into strip or cordage. And we're using them actually actively constructing some of our mere infrastructure. And the cordage is incredibly strong. So if you make a cordage that's say consisting of a dozen strands of maybe quarter inch wide PET bottle strips, you can suspend up to about 1,000 pounds onto such a cordage. So each narrow strip of your bottle can more or less suspend a person's weight.
It's incredibly strong.
So if you take, you take a like half liter bottle, you can suspend a whole family on it. And we have since tested the strength for our mirror film made out of this material, which is only 3,000 or 75 microns thick. If you have a like 1 inch wide of this material, it takes 200 pounds to break it by tension.
Wow.
So it's really indeed it's a very incredible material. We're developing some canopy systems right now out of this really thin film, and they are really mechanically robust.
Wow. Well, I just want to ask you one last question, just a topical one, because I'm sure you saw the flash floods in Dubai this week, and there was some press mentioning about cloud seeding having an effect, and obviously all the trolls on Twitter were going mad for geoengineering being the cause of that. Have you done any analysis, or can you share your analysis on what you think happened there, or what was the causation? Are the trolls correct? Was it cloud seeding?
It's not, if you don't look really analyze data, it's impossible to say for sure. But for something of that intensity to happen, there needs to be like several things in place. First of all, there needs to be enough moisture in the atmosphere, you mean, to be seeded. If the atmosphere was dry, then it wouldn't really happen.
Yes.
So even if, say, there was an artificial amplification of that precipitation event, the background atmospheric flow patterns has to be such that there's enough moisture in the air. Yeah. There needs to be strong enough atmospheric rivers. That's what's known in the field nowadays to transport that moisture there to be collected by cloud seeding.
Mm.
And many places around the world are indeed doing tropospheric cloud seeding in order to promote the stream, but nowhere do they really succeed in gaining such success. if it was so easy to use cloud seeding to get water, then water scarcity droughts would not be a problem.
Yes. Right.
So what's necessary to have those kind of moisture in the air is, you know, evaporation from the ocean. And for that to happen, you need to have a really high background temperature and also strong solar radiation over the ocean. So the cloud seeding people would have to be, you know, really careful in how to manage that, because you shouldn't be seeding over the ocean, because that would attenuate the evaporation rate. And also, if you seeded too early inland, then whatever cloud forms would also attenuate the ground surface temperature, thereby inhibiting the inland transport of the moist air, thus also attenuating the precipitation, because the flow of the atmospheric river inland would be lower when you have a cooler land surface.
Yes.
But anyway, given the scale and unprecedented nature of that event over that particular geographical region, I don't think just by virtue of cloud seeding you can coax that much water out over a desert.
No.
Because if that were, again, we have really nothing for it.
Okay, so there we go. Once again, we're out of time and we'll have to end the podcast there. I want to thank Dr. Tao, as usual, for his time and excellent answers for this fourth podcast. We'll hopefully be back again next month, delving deeper into the science and hearing updates on the project. Thanks to anyone who's tuned in on the live stream, and for those listening to this recording, I hope you find the conversation useful and enlightening as I did. Just remember, you can follow our developments at the website mir.org, or follow our X Twitter feed at MIRSRM. And once again, MIR is a non-profit, and we do appreciate any donations you can make towards our ongoing research and humanitarian efforts. To do so, go to mir.org/donate, MEER.org/donate. Thanks again.